My name is Sandy Fahler, and I am an interviewer for the UW-Madison Oral History Project. Today, Wednesday, May 17, 2006, I am interviewing Ann Burgess, who retired in 2002 as Distinguished Senior Lecturer and Director of the Biology Core Curriculum Program on the Madison campus. Good morning.
Hello.
Ann, let's start with your early history. If you could talk about where and when you were born, where you went to school, describe your childhood, your elementary school, high school. Were there any people in your life that were particular mentors for you when you were younger?
Well, I have a lot of ties to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I actually grew up in Evansville, town of 3,000, about 22 miles from here. My father was an engineer, and my mother was a stay-at-home mom. I would say my father always encouraged me to strive and work hard in school. And as far as elementary school, I do remember a seventh grade teacher, Mrs. Record, who did a lot of science, and she told me one time, "Ann, you'd be a really good scientist." And it's really interesting to look back on that, because I think I had never thought of that until she said so. Mm-hmm. And then when it came time to go to college.
High school?
Oh, high school.
Was it a good high school?
I think it was a pretty good high school in Evansville. Mm-hmm. I did have, I had some good teachers and a lot of friends, and 54 in my graduating class, so we were a pretty close bunch.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have one sister who's 2 years younger than I am, and she's an engineer, lives in California.
Okay. So then you left Evansville and you went off to college, and where did you go to college?
University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Was that your first and only choice?
I never considered going anywhere else. In my high school at that time, the strong academic students went to UW-Madison. It was very interesting when my kids were getting ready to figure out where to go to college. I didn't have any clue about looking at all the colleges in the country and deciding, because I had never been through that process. But I loved the university as an undergraduate. I was a chemistry major. And I think you would want to know about influential faculty. Very, very influential faculty member was Harvey Sorum, who was my freshman chemistry teacher. I have such fond memories of him. I knew enough of my interest in science to take the chemistry course that was designed for chemistry majors and chemical engineers, and he was the one that taught it. He was an absolutely fabulous teacher, very enthusiastic and very caring about the students, and welcomed us into his office. So I did go to see him a lot of times when I had questions. He was so encouraging and remained friends of mine. When we came back to Madison, he was emeritus then, but he had an office in the chemistry building. He used to come over and see me in Nolan Hall occasionally. It was really fun. So he was a very big influence. And well, I was a chemistry major and I liked science, but when I was a junior, I started taking biology classes and liked those very much. And was I wanted to find out more about science and research, and sought out a summer job where I could work in a lab, and got hired by a graduate student in McArdle. His name is Jed Spaulding, and he's a graduate student at that time. He's, of course, long since become a faculty member of Jerry Mueller in McArdle. And Jerry was actually off on sabbatical when this started, but when he came, so I worked in the lab and I loved it. And when Jerry Mueller got back, he said, "Ann, you should do a senior thesis project with me." So I got started doing my own research with Jerry Mueller, and he was incredibly encouraging about going to graduate school.
Now, what was the work that you did in the lab?
Well, I was working on a lot of things having to do with cell cycle, but I was assisting the graduate student, Jed Spaulding, and we were measuring a lot of things that, so he had a mechanism of synchronizing HeLa cells so that they would all undergo mitosis at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then they were studying lots of different characteristics as a function of cell cycle. So I remember we used to get these cells synchronized, and then we'd have this like 24-hour long experiment where we had to take points every 2 hours. or every 4 hours. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was. We did these huge experiments that took a huge amount of time, and then we'd have a couple days off. And Jed was very interested in teaching, and he used to take me into the lecture room and give me little lectures on things relevant. So he really encouraged me too. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky to work there. And then the summer after, my senior year, I did a project with Jerry Mueller, which I still remember that. It was the partition of DNA and a multi-phase system with countercurrent distribution. They don't do anything like that anymore. But I have a really strong memory about that one time, though, and I was talking about my results with Jerry, and he said, and I explained something, and I said, and that isn't the result. That isn't what it's supposed to be. And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, Ann, the first thing you got to learn about science is you go by your results, not by what you're supposed to get. And I still remember that. And I quote that to my students a lot.
That's a good lesson.
And Jerry was very, very encouraged. I mean, he's one of, Harvey Sorum and Jerry Mueller were the two biggest influences in my life as an undergraduate. And Jerry encouraged me to go to graduate school, and he asked me where I was applying, and I told him this list.
Okay, back up though.
Okay.
Now, were you one of the few women in the chemistry department, or as a student, were
yes.
there? You were. Okay.
Yes. In fact, I remember now there's all these learning communities and women in science and engineering dorm and things like that. I think it's so wonderful, and I'm so glad they're doing that. Because I do remember feeling very isolated in the dorm. I lived in Chadron Hall the first 2 years. It was an all-women's dorm at that time. Though back in those olden days, they segregated the men and the women. Mm-hmm. And if I had a question about a chemistry problem, there wasn't anybody around that I could just go work with. Whereas in the men's dorms, lots of people were. And I didn't know anybody well enough to call them up and do it on the phone. So. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize at the time, I was very isolated, but I didn't realize it at the time. Mm-hmm. The other thing I do remember, though, is people treated me as weird because I was a chemistry major.
Other women students, you mean, or any students?
Everybody.
Everybody?
And I belonged to a sorority, and we used to have to go to these things called beer suppers that I just hated. I hated those things, but it was required to go. So the sorority and the fraternity would get together for this Friday night dinner. And some fraternity guy would come up to me and start a conversation, and then pretty soon he'd ask me what I'm majoring in, and when I said chemistry, usually he'd just turn around and walk away. So anyway, that's the atmosphere of chemistry. And while I'm talking about sororities, anybody that got engaged, they had this huge ceremony. Everybody was I can't remember how they called us to the living room, but it'd be a darkened living room, and you'd pass around a candle, and the person who got engaged blew out the candle, and oh, it was such a big deal. I got a fellowship to Harvard, and it wasn't a big deal to anybody. And I just remember thinking how ironic. So,
so all right. Okay. So, but you enjoyed your 4 years at Madison.
I really did enjoy my 4 years, and I really had a wonderful time as a student helper in Jerry Mueller's lab at McCardle.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody there treated me wonderfully and encouraged me. It was a lot of fun. The other thing, I have a very happy memory about that. So I told you we did these enormous experiments. And then we'd have a day off, or sometimes the day off, but often during lunch period, we would put on our swimming suits. McCardle wasn't air conditioned at that time. In the summertime, at noon, we'd put on our swimming suits under our lab coats, and we'd walk over to the Liz Waters Pier, and we'd have lunch and swim in Lake Mendota during lunch hour. And then when we were celebrating one of these big experiments, we didn't have just the hour over at the Liz Waters Pier. We had several hours because we were recovering from the 24-hour experiment.
Sure.
So, and I got to know several faculty members at the Liz Waters Pier when I was working as a student helper.
So when did you know you were going to go on to graduate school?
Well, I think this experience working in the lab, I really enjoyed. I liked it more than classwork, and I liked the atmosphere, and it was also fun. Chemistry had been okay, and I liked it, but biology excited me a whole lot more somehow. Mm-hmm. So what I ended up doing is going to graduate school in molecular biology and biochemistry at Harvard, and they had a program special interdisciplinary program in biochemistry and molecular biology.
Okay, and how did you choose? Is that why you chose Harvard?
I had applied several places. So I have to tell Shidori about Jerry Mueller.
Right.
So I was telling you before that he encouraged me to go to graduate school. And I'm sure he's the reason I got in because of the letters he wrote and stuff. But I gave him this list of places I was applying. He said, I don't see Harvard on the list. And I said, I'm never going to get admitted to Harvard. Well, he says, you sure aren't going to get admitted if you don't apply. So I did apply, and I did get admitted. So it was interesting. I did not get admitted to MIT. You knew right away, because if you got admitted, you got this great big packet. If you didn't get admitted, you got a postcard. I got a postcard from MIT saying, your name is not among those of the accepted graduate students. It was about the coolest thing you can imagine.
Well, you must remember when you found out you got admitted to Harvard.
Well, I got this big letter. And I was so excited. And, you know, I went around the sorority and said, hey, look. And the response I got was not enthusiasm. It was sort of like, one woman said to me, why'd you want to do that?
Oh,
anyway, so then I didn't go around quite so enthusiastically telling everybody. But, of course, I called my parents, and they were enthusiastic. And like I said, my father had always encouraged my interest in.
Mm-hmm. So what was the fellowship? What did that cover?
It was some kind of a training grant. These are very common even now, which pays your tuition and a stipend.
Oh, okay.
And so... Anyway, I decided to accept it,
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad I did, because that's, among other things, where I met my husband. There were six of us in the entering graduate class at
uh-huh.
Harvard. I was the only woman.
And he was also?
And he was in the same program.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, what was the experience like? Like the first week you were in
Boston? I was terrified.
Yeah.
I was sure they're going to figure out that I didn't belong at Harvard. I didn't know enough. And I spent the whole first year in the basement of the chemistry library studying.
Yeah.
It was very exciting. It was fun taking classes. And it was, it was very stressful because I was worried all the time. But the way they do it at Harvard is you take courses intensely the first year, but then after that, I don't think I took any courses after the first year. Then I was working in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
My major professor is named David Denhardt, and he was an assistant professor who was kind of associated with Jim Watson's lab. There was several assistant professors who, we had all our seminars together and parties and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. So I was not in the Watson group, but pretty closely associated. And my husband, Dick Burgess, was a student of Jim Watson's.
I see.
So that was more connections. And in fact, so it was a very nice situation because I had a lot of attention from the man that was my supervisor, who was only like 3 years older than I. But I also could talk to other people and go be part of this bigger group. It was very exciting. There were so many things going on. It was just at the time when they were figuring out all kinds of things about basic molecular biology and transcription and whether it's 3' to 5', or 5' to 3', and how ribosomes worked and how initiation worked and how repression worked and mapping a lot of phage genes. My thesis project was, I worked on a virus called VIX-174, and it's a very tiny virus, only has 10 genes, and we were trying to figure out what they are. And originally they thought this virus was going to be really easy to figure out because it was so small, but then it turned out, of course, it depends a lot more on the host than a virus that has more of its own genes. So it wasn't quite so easy to figure things out.
Now, what years were you there then at Harvard?
I graduated from UW-Madison in 64. I was at Harvard from 64 to 69, got my PhD in 69.
And then what happened to you?
Well, so in 1967, I married Richard Burgess,
mm-hmm.
a fellow graduate student, and we decided we would like to go somewhere to Europe as postdocs, and there was kind of a track that people from the Watson lab either went to Cambridge, England, or Geneva, Switzerland, and we ended up going to Geneva, Switzerland. I wanted to work on animal viruses, and I worked with a man named Bernard Mach, who was in a department. Well, but we started out in the same department. Dick was working with Alfred Tissier in the Institut de Biologie Moléculaire. And at one point, it moved to a new building, and the person I was working with actually joined a different department, but it was in the same building. So anyway, that worked out very well, and I got experience in a very different area, working with animal cells.
What was life like living in Switzerland and being a post-grad?
Oh, that was a lot of fun. I mean, we worked hard in the lab, but we played hard too. And there was it was a wonderful time. There was a large number of international, but a lot of Americans, but European and Canadian postdocs in this Geneva lab. And there was a wonderful atmosphere. We had a lot of fun. Everybody worked hard, but then we went skiing a lot, and we went on hikes, and we went in the mountains, and we had some very close friends that we've continued to be friends with all these years. They live in Australia, actually, but and then the four of us did lots of things together, and that's before any of us had kids, so we had a lot of freedom. We went out to dinner all the time, or cooked together, and hiked, and did science together.
Sounds wonderful.
It really was a wonderful time.
Were you able to travel a little bit too?
We did. Suzanne, one of these friends, was very good at instigating trips. We wouldn't have gone nearly so many places if she hadn't said, "Okay, we have to go to Provence. We have to go to Greece."
Oh,
so it really was fun. And then Dick was offered a job at the University of Wisconsin, which was sort of amazing. And I was delighted because I love Madison. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, postdoc time is time where everybody's looking for jobs. And I had decided not to try to look for a job independent of Dick. But I would just, when we figured out where he was going to go, I would look for what I could do. And lo and behold, not only did he get offered a job at University of Wisconsin, he offered a job in McArdle Laboratory, my old stomping grounds.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
and that was in 70, 90?
So that was 71. We were in Switzerland for 2 years.
Okay.
So 71, initially I worked in his lab, although I collaborated with some of the other people.
Here in Madison?
In Madison.
Okay.
For 2 years, but then I was kind of looking for doing something on my own.
Now you worked in his lab, this was a paid job?
Yes. Yeah, okay, so the first year we were here, I was a postdoc in his lab.
Okay.
And the second year I was promoted to be an assistant scientist, which is a pretty funny title.
And you worked well together?
We did, but it was a little hard on me because we'd always been equal before that. And all of a sudden he was a professor and I was not equal. And people kind of ignored me in the lab unless they couldn't get a hold of him. And I don't think of myself as a person with a big ego, but I was feeling like I was getting lost somehow. Mm-hmm. And something had happened during that, I can't remember now, probably the second year. We'd gotten an invitation to participate in a discussion about this program called Biology Core Curriculum. They were inviting people to get involved, particularly in the labs. They wanted some new labs for the program, and Dick and I went to a meeting where we talked about all this, and we both agreed to do a lab. So he did one on protein purification. Gosh, I can't even remember what I did mine on. I did this lab, and one of the people involved in this is Walter Plout, who was at that time the chair of the BioCore program, and Millard Sussman. Somebody who continues to be a friend. I helped Walt with a lab on microscopy, and I did another one of my own, which I'm blanking now what it was, which it seems like it should be significant to me, but I really liked doing it. It was really fun. I liked interacting with the students, and I liked the team, the faculty team. And so it's just at the time when I was having these thoughts about, I ought to look around for something else. I went to see Walt, who I had known. He was one of the people who got me excited about biology when I was an undergraduate. And I, so I knew him from when I had been his student. And I knew him from this BioCore interaction and working with him in the lab. And I went to see him. I said, I just want to come and talk to you about, to get give me some advice, because I'm looking for something new. And I'm not sure what it is, but I loved what I was doing with BioCore. And I thought, you're so connected with teaching, well, maybe you have some ideas. And he said, matter of fact, we were just thinking of hiring somebody to run the lab for BioCore, because we have a different person coming in every week doing something different. And lots of times in week two, students have questions about week one, but week one person isn't there anymore. And we're thinking, we need somebody to coordinate this and make it all together better. Would you be interested in that?
Oh, my.
And I said, that sounds really interesting. They're really intriguing. And he said, I'll go talk to the dean. Talk to the dean, offered me the position. I mean, it was totally classic old boys never.
Right.
And I just happened to know one of the old boys. No posting the position or
anything.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So that's how I got involved in BioCore. I first was teaching the cell biology lab.
Well, tell us what is BioCore?
Oh, yes. So it is a interdepartmental honors program. It was started in 67, and the people who started it, Miller Sussman was one of them, Bob Metzenberg was another. They had the idea that this is such a strong campus in biology, we should have a really strong introductory biology program. And I think they in the very beginning, they envisioned it as something all the biology majors would go through, but it very quickly turned into the honors track. So, and it had been expanded just at the time I got involved. Every year there were more students who wanted to do this. It was the more challenging route to go through introductory biology. And it's a 4-semester program, so the other introductory biology is only 2 semesters. Mm-hmm. This was 4-semester integrated, and there were a series of chemistry, math, and physics courses that were semi-required. I mean, chemistry was absolutely required because people had to take that. They wanted people to have a very firm foundation in chemistry before they started biology. So BioCore didn't start until people were sophomores, having had a year of chemistry. So, I mean, I could talk for hours and hours about BioCore. So at that point, we had... So I was teaching the labs, and we had, I think we had 9 3-hour labs a week. I mean, we started Monday afternoon, and it was actually too much to handle, and some of the Friday, Wednesday and Friday morning labs were undersubscribed because people had so many conflicts with other courses. So it kind of settled down to 6 3-hour labs.
Now, were these labs, these physically, were these labs all over campus, or was this all in one?
This took place in Noland Hall. Okay. So the students who enrolled in this program, at that time, cell biology was the first course in the program. Mm-hmm. And the students would take a 3-credit lecture course and a 2-credit lab course. So, but it was intended that they take them together. So almost everybody was taking this 5-credit program. And at the same time, as sophomores, they were taking organic chemistry and many of them taking second semester calculus. So it was a very heavy load on the students. Mm-hmm. And this was the laboratory course continued to be very research oriented, and students analyzing data, writing reports, modeling the format of scientific papers. So the students complained all the time that it was too much work for 2 credits.
Mm.
But one of the strengths of the lab, of the program, was what experienced students got in lab. They also, faculty came into the labs. It's been so many years, and there were so many different configurations of how we arranged all the labs to accommodate them. By that point, this is the early 70s now, there were so many students wanting to take the program. What happened eventually is we had this was encouraged by the deans, because what would happen is there'd be more students wanting to come and take the program, and we would keep asking for more TAs. And so the dean said, look, you have to have an enrollment limit. You have to know how many students you have so we can plan ahead and you can plan ahead. And that actually made everything, we were not happy with that enrollment limit when the dean imposed it on us, but in fact, it was a very good thing to do because it made it much easier for everybody to plan ahead of time and hire TAs in a timely way. And so at that point, students had to apply to get into BioCorps before anybody who was willing to take on the rigor of the program was welcomed. And it, so, well, so anyway, I was in charge of the cell biology labs. And at one point, as I said, we're trying to accommodate so many people. We were actually teaching the cell biology labs fall and spring, even though the other courses in the program only were, the people who took it in the spring in the beginning were out of sequence.
Oh.
But there were so many people wanting to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that, you know, we had these different things that we tried, and that was not a very workable, those were orphan students, because then they were out of sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So it settled down to cell biology in the fall and other course, another course in the spring, which was, for a while, was developmental biology, and then was course called biological diversity. So there's a whole history of BioCorps and what courses got taught, but I pretty early on got involved in the second semester course, and then somehow got just more and more involved in everything because I was the person who was around all the time, and I liked the students a lot. I did a lot of student advising. I got involved in faculty advising service, which just meant that you were one of their list of, LNS had a whole list of advisors from different departments, and they, this advising service students could call up and request an appointment, and if they said biology or pre-med, they put them on my list, and I'd go up there for a couple hours a week and talk to students. And I became very aware through that process of how difficult it was for students to figure out which biology major to undertake, because there was something like 30 biology majors.
Hmm.
So that's a whole other story about the biology major and me getting involved in that.
Well, that's one of the questions I had. How, when you got to the point where students had to apply, what kind of application and what did you have to have to get in?
Well, that's a very good question. And there, so there was a BioCorps governed by a faculty, staff, student committee, and that was a decision-making body. But what we came up with, I didn't want to admit students solely on the basis of their grades because it would be their first semester grades, and a lot of people struggle in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I also didn't want to have people choosing the easier course sequence so they'll get a better grade. So, for example, you know, taking the chemistry 103, 104 instead of 19, 110, the one for chemistry majors. I wanted to encourage students to take the most challenging program.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what it was a very short application form that they had to fill out, and it asked them questions. They did have to say the, and we actually made calculus a prerequisite too. That was another way of controlling the enrollment, because we looked at the grades of people who had taken calculus did much better in BioCorps than those who hadn't, and it wasn't because we depended so much on calculus. It was because people who took calculus were the stronger students.
Sure.
Who were headed toward programs that needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And one other reason for requiring calculus actually though is their program, biology majors such as biochemistry required it, so we wanted students to get the message that if you're serious, you need to be taking calculus.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but as I said, there was a high correlation between having taken calculus and done well and doing well in BioCorps. So one of the things was the prerequisites then became chemistry and calculus, and concurrent enrollment in organic chemistry, because by then cell biology was the second semester course. We wanted a big picture course first. So, I mean, you know, I'm sort of getting sidetracked with the history of BioCorps and the history of Ann, but we had times when a group of us, some of the core people, spent a lot of time discussing what would be the ideal sequence, and should we be, originally it started from small things and worked up to big things. So we started with molecules and ended with ecosystems.
Mm.
But there were a lot of reasons why it was good to have students have the big picture first. So in fact, now for many, many years, we start with evolution and ecology and genetics because everybody wanted to build on genetics, and then cell biology is second.
Sure.
So anyway, at the time when all these things were happening, cell biology became a spring semester course instead of the fall semester first course in the program.
And you were the lab director at this time?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was the lab director actually of the evolution. So my role at that point was director of evolution, ecology, and genetics in the fall semester lab and cell biology lab in the spring.
Okay.
But all involved in lab. And in 1980, Walt made me the associate chair of the program, and I'd actually been doing a lot of administrative things like writing memos to the deans about budgets and TAs and stuff like that. I'd been doing a lot of that all along. But the core group of us met for a lot of long time and got lots of input from people. Not everybody agreed with this, but that's when we decided to start with the big picture evolution stuff first.
And your title at that time was senior lecturer.
Yes.
Or a lecturer.
Like, even though I was teaching labs, I wasn't lecturing. But that was decided to be the appropriate title when I was hired, and then it never got changed. When my successor was hired, I think her title is faculty associate, not lecturer. Okay, well, anyway, so I can't remember where I was headed here.
I'm sorry.
So BioCorp, we were talking.
Okay, you were talking about the labs.
Okay. Well, I guess let me just finish up about sort of overview of my career with BioCorp, and then we'll maybe go into more detail about what's special about the BioCorp labs. So in 1980, I became associate chair of the program on top of the lab stuff I was doing. And through the late 70s and 80s, I became much more involved in campus issues in biology education, and more involved with the whole BioCorp program. And then a very sad thing happened in 1990. Walter Clout, who had been chair of BioCorp all those years that I was involved, died very unexpectedly and very suddenly of a heart attack. In fact, he was giving a lecture to biology 101 students, zoology 101 students, and he collapsed. And one of the students was an EMT, and they immediately called 911, and anyway, he was rushed to the hospital, but he never woke up. He died that day. And it was so sudden and so unexpected. And he was a very healthy person, and he played squash and all these things. Anyway, the committee that governed BioCorp met very shortly after, and very quickly and unanimously chose me to be the new chair of BioCorp. Of course, these were all people I worked with and people who knew that I'd already been doing a lot of administrative stuff with the program. Anyway, it was a real exciting time for me, and a real, somehow, gave me a lot of self-confidence that I hadn't quite had before that, and gave me the confidence to feel free to talk to the chancellor and anybody else who had to find out about BioCorp. And there was it took the university a while to decide if they could allow an academic staff person to be head of this flagship honors program, because it had always been headed by a faculty member. But there weren't any other likely candidates, and they finally accepted it. So in 1990, I became director. They wouldn't let me be chair, but they decided I could be director. So my title was director of BioCorp. And it was very exciting for me because before I'd had lots of ideas about things that I wanted to do. I would propose them to Walt, and even though we had a great working relationship and I really respected him, he was involved in lots of other things. He was chair of zoology. Most of these things took a lot of work, and he wasn't eager to take on a whole bunch of new things. So now I could take on any new things I wanted to, and it was very exciting. So I was then director of the program, and what that meant, besides I continued to be in charge of the two labs, which is extremely time-consuming, which involved a lot of TA training, a lot of student interactions, and assistance with their papers and all that kind of stuff. But recruiting faculty to BioCorp has always been an issue because they're not paid to teach in BioCorp, and most departments, some departments are great and consider it part of somebody's normal teaching role. Botany, I want to give a big cheer to Botany, has always considered teaching in BioCorp to be equivalent to teaching in Botany, but many departments don't count it. I mean, there's some department chairs, particularly in College of Agriculture, who told faculty, if you want to teach in BioCorp, that's fine. But as far as we're concerned, that's like teaching in Sunday school. You do that on your own time.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Anyway, the wonderful thing about the team in BioCorp is you were people who, they loved doing it because the students were so much fun to teach. They're honor students, they're very motivated. Sure. They're all there because they want to work hard and learn. And that's a big draw to faculty. But it's very difficult when you're running a whole program. And so this was 4 lecture courses and 3 lab courses. Well, the labs were taught by academic staff, but we had a tradition of having the faculty present in a lot of the labs. And a lot of the original founding fathers, like Millard Sussman and Bob Metzenberg, when it was their week that their lab was going on, they'd come to all of the labs. And that's what one of the things that made BioCorp special was all this faculty interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan Pelican was another one. He would come to all the labs when he was teaching. Anyway, but so recruiting faculty, on the one hand, faculty who cared a lot about teaching in undergraduates and found that extremely rewarding were very drawn to BioCorp. On the other hand, they were, in many cases, expected to do this on top of all their normal responsibilities, so that made it very, very difficult. And there are people who liked teaching and liked BioCorp and liked the students, but they were just overwhelmed by all that they were expected to do. So what happened is people would come and teach in BioCorp, but then they would decide they just can't handle it and they got to give up something, or they would be made chair of some program and they'd have to look at their collection of things on their plate and decide they had to give up something, and so here was this volunteer thing in BioCorp. So recruiting faculty was something I spent a huge amount of time doing. And it helped that I'd been so connected all over campus with all these other things I'd gotten involved, so I knew a lot of people. It's a lot easier to recruit people that you know than strangers.
Right, hard to say no, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing I learned is you do it way ahead of time. You know, you start like a year and a half before you know getting people because they're much more willing to commit. Well, next year I won't be so busy as I am now, but of course you will be.
Yeah.
So recruiting faculty was a big responsibility. And, there were lots of efforts at various times to try to figure out a better system because Biology 151, 152, the 2-semester introductory sequence, also had trouble recruiting faculty because they were expanding. Biology was expanding all over campus and student interest. I think something like over a quarter of students who enter the university are headed for some kind of biological science major. Anyway, and all these people have to take introductory biology.
Mm-hmm.
So both BioCorp and 151, 152 had this continual problem of recruiting faculty to teach in the program. So there was lots of meetings with lots of bodies about how we could make this work better. And it was very wearing down too. And the other thing with this volunteer program is, like I said, people were doing it on top of their normal stuff. So lots of times they were supposed to do something for BioCorp, like write an exam, and it just didn't quite get done, and it would be 2 days before the exam, and it hadn't gotten started, so I jump in because, no, it's not the faculty that suffer if there's a bad exam,
sure.
It's the students that suffer.
Right.
And so I was doing all this stuff all the time and sort of exhausted.
How many hours a week did you work?
Oh,
for
I had
12 years.
I had a lot of 14-hour days. I had a lot of times when I hadn't planned. You know, I sort of had looked ahead, and I had the lab all set up, and everything was, and then all of a sudden I'd have an exam to work on. And I don't want to make this as a criticism of the faculty, because it was just because they were so involved in so many things, and somehow the date sort of slipped up, and there it was. So I'd end up getting involved in these things that took a huge amount of time, and it was a huge crisis. I mean, I sort of a lot of time felt like the little boy with his finger in the dike, but I had all 10 fingers in the dike. And Dick would say to me, Ann, and I would, you know, I'd complain about it, and he'd say,
they know you're going to do it. They know that you'll pick up the pieces. And so it's your own fault. And then I think, but it's the students that'll suffer if we have a bad exam. So anyway, that's my responsibilities. And when I finally decided to retire, it was just sort of an overwhelming job, and I was frustrated that the university kept promising to figure out a better way to recruit faculty, because that was really a big, big issue. If there were some kind of compensation for people teaching in BioCorp, or every department was counting this as a big chunk of somebody's teaching time so that they got out of something else,
right,
then people would have more time to do what they needed to do, mm-hmm, and it wouldn't be kind of patching stuff together at the last minute.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the advantage of this system, and I probably shouldn't even say this, is but it really selected for people that really cared about teaching. And there are people on this campus who really do care about teaching, and usually department conversations over lunch and stuff are not about teaching. And here was BioCorp was a place where you could have all these conversations. And I instituted, as soon as I became director, a monthly chairs meeting. We'd get together and have breakfast together and talk about whatever the issues were then. Mm-hmm. Partly to give me input on what they were thinking about things that I had to deal with, so I could be making community decisions, not unilateral decisions. But also, again, just to give these people that love teaching a venue where they could have a conversation about it and struggle with the issues that we were struggling with. How can we do this better? How can we connect? This is a four-semester sequence. How can we do a better job at connecting and building on what we do in one semester to lead into another semester?
Now, is it still a unique program to Wisconsin? Or are there other programs like this in other campuses?
Bob Maxenberg, who's one of the founders, told me that at the time when BioCorp was founded, it was happening all across the country. They were doing lots and lots of programs like this, but most of them didn't last very long.
Oh. It's still going on, right?
Oh, BioCorp's still going strong. Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, when I retired, they decided to split my responsibilities among two people. One person to do the interacting with the university and recruiting, and another person to the lab. In fact, in reality, what's happened is the person doing the lab is doing what I used to do.
Oh.
So I don't know how well it's working, but it's because the other person, who is a wonderful teacher and a wonderful person, has a million other things on his plate. The advantage to academic staff is you can focus on the thing that you're supposed to do, whereas it's very hard for faculty or have all these different responsibilities that they have to juggle.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the BioCorp's still going strong, which I'm very happy. I'm very delighted with the new team. They're wonderful people, and they even care about the Prairie, which is one of our... So when we get... Okay, I think I finished Anne.
Okay.
Now I got me retired. So now we can talk about teaching labs.
All right.
So there's been a big movement in science education, biology education. One of the big leaders is something called the BioQuest Consortium that I got involved with many years ago, based at Beloit College, but it's a national movement, who feel very strongly that the way to teach science is for students to do science. It's not to my kids got turned off of biology in high school because they had to memorize a bunch of stuff, and they saw biology, they didn't see it as something fun, they saw it as memorize all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in college, I think for many years that happened a lot, that there was a lot of memorize all this stuff kind of teaching the biology. But now what more and more people are trying to do is teach the process of science, and BioCorp's been way at the front of that from the very beginning. And the labs, we're trying over the years more and more successfully to have students working on projects where they're doing real science. They're asking their own question, and they're designing their own experiment, and they're getting their results, and they're drawing conclusions, and maybe the results don't support their hypothesis, and that's very hard for the students because they think they failed somehow. But we keep emphasizing, No, that leads you to the next step. And that's what science is. It's not about getting the right answer. It's about finding out how the world works and doing experiments and then going on to the next experiment. If you get a surprising result, that's telling you something. And so as I said, the students work in teams to do this. And then the other thing that BioCore has emphasized from the very beginning, from before I was involved, but I totally supported this, is becoming a writing intensive course. So all of our lab courses are writing intensive courses. And students, because part of the process of science is presenting your ideas to peers and convincing the scientific community that your ideas are correct. So this whole idea of doing an experiment is not enough. You have to get it out there for criticism. So the students have to do that, and they have to write. And because we want them to learn, a very, very big goal in BioCore was to help the students improve their writing ability. So they had to write individual reports, even though they worked as a team, and we encourage all kinds of interaction and collaboration and discussion, but then they had to go home and write the reports on their own. And then many times they would turn them in. Sometimes they had peer reviews of their reports. Sometimes they had a chance to turn it in, get a grade, and rewrite it, because we learned from the writing people, Brad Hughes et al., who's been wonderfully helpful in this whole process over many, many years. Rewriting is how you learn. Before I got clued in by him, I had assumed that students turn in a lab report, they get all these comments about the strengths and weaknesses of their lab report, and then they learn from that, they read all that, and then they use all that, what they learned, to write their next lab report. It isn't how it works, because when they get this lab report back, they got a grade on it, that's done, they put that in their file. They don't look at all those comments. You spent so many, many hours writing out the comments about the strengths and weaknesses of their paper. So if you want them to read all that, they have to redo the same paper. So that's one of the many things I learned from Brad Hughes. Another one is to emphasize rewriting, not editing. You know, don't go in and edit the student's paper. Give them big picture comments and make them redo it and edit it. So anyway, in 1997, we started the BioCore Prairie Restoration Project. So we had, in the Evolution, Ecology, and Genetics Lab, had been doing a project called our Pickle Jar Experiment, where we went out to University Bay and collected all these critters and plants and mud and everything, and students brought it back to the lab, and they worked in a team of two, and they made their own aquarium in a gallon glass pickle jar, and they put in what they wanted, and then it worked amazingly well. They had their own little ecosystem, and they were all different. We had to encourage them in the beginning not to put in too much, because they had the idea the more you put in, the better it's going to be, but in fact, the less you put in, the healthier this stuff will be, because you can't overload the system.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this was one of our projects that, but the trouble with this project is the students didn't see it as real. They saw it as something they're doing for the lab. For Evolution and Ecology, I wanted a real project. And just at this time, there was a big presentation by Virginia Klein, who was the ecologist at the Arboretum. At that time, the Arboretum was managing all the campus natural areas. And they just announcing a master plan for the campus natural areas. And one of the big things was for community and class groups to take on an area and follow the master plan, but to do the work and the restoration, a way for hands-on learning and also getting the work done.
Mm-hmm.
And so the person, Kurt Kaslavka, who was our laboratory manager, and I, we got very excited about this, and we walked all over deciding where would we like to do a project. And we picked this little spot that's between Picnic Point and the Eagle Heights Community Gardens, which is an old weedy field, to do prairie restoration. So we started this project for the course. This is totally real, and it's fraught with all kinds of problems and difficulties, because when you're doing something that's real, you don't know how it's going to come out, mm-hmm. and the data are very messy. Anyway, well, we got the students involved, and this has now been handed on, this project. Started out 6/10 of an acre,
last fall, we just planted 6.5 more acres. The whole thing is now 9 acres. Huh. It's not prairie yet. Parts of it are prairie, but mm-hmm. there's different parts that have been planted at different times. And it's not just getting the students out there to work and do data collection, but every year they talk about what's going on and propose some experiments. So, for example, the first year, the experiment that we did was to figure out what's the best way to get rid of the weeds, because it's an old weedy field, and that's a big challenge. It's a much bigger challenge than I realized when we started all this. Yeah. So we divided this 6/10 of an acre into 9 plots, and 3 got mulched, and 3 got herbicided, and 3 got rototilled every couple weeks to figure out what's the best way to control the weeds. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, and then students become involved in this, and they learn about replication, and they learn about error analysis and significant figures and mm-hmm. and standard error, and they have to be able to look at some data and decide, can you draw any conclusion? In fact, what it turned out, I mean, it took us several years to get enough data to actually decide that there was no difference between the weed treatment programs. In fact, none of them were very successful. Mm. But the students every year would be part of some ongoing experiment. I mean, there are different experiments started mm-hmm. all along, and even the pre-meds got very excited about prairie restoration. Huh. So that's an example. But then they would have to, we would have all these data that students would analyze, and it was a very big challenge to me to figure out how to make this doable by introductory students, and how to, for example, what we would do is give different teams different sets of species to analyze. So we'd go out and get all these data about what's growing out there. And of course, they had to learn plant identification and things like that. And they did quite a little plots that they looked at what's inside the plot. But figuring out how to put all the data together and then separate it into pieces that different teams could work on mm-hmm. was the challenge. But anyway, we figured out all that, and I'm hoping that the students will come back years later and bring their families and say, I helped in that prairie.
Right.
And it became a model, actually, for lots of other programs to do research in the Campus Natural mm-hmm. Areas, and which mm-hmm. is now called the University of Wisconsin Nature Lakeshore Nature Preserve.
That's right. I was just by it the other day. I didn't, now that I know this story, I'm going to have to go back and take a closer look. That's great.
So, and in the other courses, each semester of BioCorps, we progress more in this mode of having them design their own experiments. By the third semester lab, the organismal biology lab, they spend most of the semester on a really big project that they're working in team. It's their question and their methods, and mm-hmm. and then they do PowerPoint presentations to their rest of their classmates at the end, and in fact invite in a lot of faculty and interested other people. So one of the things about the BioCorps lab was this whole process of science, not a cookbook lab where you know the answer in the beginning,
right.
But and another nice thing about students designing their own experiments is they're coming up with new things all the time. So you have less worry about last year's materials in the fraternity files and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Now, did you survey the students after they're finished with the program, and is it pretty much overall satisfactory or more than satisfactory as far as the students are concerned?
I would say overall, students who go through the program are very enthusiastic about it, and we tend to hear many years later from the ones who are enthusiastic. We don't hear years later from the ones who are unhappy, but we get comments back many years later about, I didn't realize how wonderful this program was until I became a TA at, you know, X university,
sure.
and see how they teach introductory biology. Or somebody will write back and say how well it prepared them for medical school or whatever.
Yeah.
Or one very common theme is the writing experience. At the time, I hated it. I just hated it.
Yeah.
But it's the most useful thing I learned
uh-huh.
in the whole 4 semesters.
Sure.
So I guess the other thing that is different about BioCorps is I really pushed this. The whole idea of cooperative learning and students interacting with each other, much, much more learning occurs when students are discussing things than when they're passively taking notes from a professor lecturing. Mm-hmm. So that we wanted the four semester course, so there's a four course sequence. We wanted the fourth semester to be a course where students pull together what they've been learning from the previous semesters. And I wanted it not to be a lecture course. It was very hard recruiting faculty who would be willing to do this, but when I was going through this process, that was the ground rules. I mean, we're going to teach a totally new kind of course. And I was very fortunate in being able to recruit some new young faculty who hadn't ever taught in other ways, or one in particular who was very frustrated with the old ways and embraced this totally. And so we came up with this cooperative learning. It was focused around papers in different areas of biology. So they picked there were four faculty who had each took a topic, and there were topics that the faculty member was interested in but would draw on several areas of biology. And then students read papers from, worked in teams of about four students, and they read papers from the primary literature, and then a large part of their grade was these worksheets that they did cooperatively in class. And they had to, we got lots of advice about people who do cooperative learning, because accountability is a really big issue. If you've got a team working on a team worksheet where they're going to get one grade, some members of the team aren't prepared, the whole thing falls apart because everybody gets mad at the ones who aren't prepared. And
sure.
So that accountability was a really big thing. So we structured it so there was a quiz the day before. The quiz questions were, have you prepared for this experience? Not in-depth thought questions, but lots of straightforward questions out of the reading.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a study guide for each week also that gave some background information, because sometimes students needed to know something that they hadn't learned in the previous bio-course semesters. So there was a quiz every Tuesday, and then Wednesday they did this group worksheet. And the quiz, of course, gets everybody prepared because they get an individual grade on that. And we ask them very challenging questions on these worksheets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the idea is to ask such challenging questions that it would be very hard for somebody to do it on their own. But when they discuss it as a team of four very smart, well-prepared people, they can do it.
Right.
So that course, and I'm very enthusiastic about that, because I think it did help them. It gave us opportunity to go back and draw from the other semesters, because one of the things that seems to happen is students, when the semester ends and the final exam is over, it's like they close that part.
Yeah.
And so we kept having to draw back. We told them, keep all your textbooks, and we would refer back to,
mm-hmm.
remember when we studied genetics? So the reason I'm describing all this is because there were quite mixed feelings about this cooperative course as the capstone course.
Wow.
Some students loved it and thought that they learned more than they ever learned before, and some students hated it.
Now, when the students come into this, to the program, is that all that they're taking?
It's five credits each semester. Right, it's five. The first three semesters are five credits. The fourth semester, this capstone course, is only three credits. It doesn't have a lab.
I see.
So they're taking very challenging courses in addition to this. So it's very hard. It's a very big challenge for the
students.
And
if somebody is struggling, is there individual help?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
One of the things that's a really big advantage about BioCourse, we have more TA support than the number of students that we teach, we have more TAs than other courses would for that number of students.
That's
and
right.
Part of it's because they do so. The exams are essay exams. They're not machine-graded exams.
Sure.
And all these laboratory reports have to be graded. And the TAs do that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I spent a huge amount of time working with the TAs. And we would do these workshops in the beginning where we would talk about a paper and everybody grading the same thing and discussing it, because students are very sensitive to my roommate's TA is easier graded than my TA.
Oh, yeah.
So we're trying to be very hard to be consistent.
Sure.
But anyway, so there was, and we are also, BioCorps had gotten a reputation of being a really good place to be a TA for, especially future faculty people who want to get some teaching experience,
mm-hmm.
and especially some non-standard teaching experience. Also, so we, we were very lucky because it was a desirable place to be a TA, so we could interview people and pick the best candidates as TAs. And I learned as much from the TAs as they ever learned from me. It was a total partnership and wonderful experience working with those graduate students.
Sounds like just a fantastic program. And you said that a lot of the programs in other campuses have not, on other campuses, have not continued.
That's what Bob Metzenberg told me.
Yeah, that's really sad.
Yeah.
But I would think then that students would be drawn to Wisconsin, science students would be drawn to Wisconsin because of the program.
There are some people who told us that they had heard about it ahead of time and mm-hmm. they wanted to come here because mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, we've talked about teaching. Let's see. What are the most significant developments in your field of study?
Okay.
And I know that's a broad field, so talk about any part of it or all parts of it.
Well, I think I should talk about teaching since we're...
Okay.
I alluded to some of this earlier. There's been, in all of science education, there's been a big movement toward making the labs investigatory labs rather than cookbook labs, and in the lecture part of the course, there's been a very big movement about involving students in some kind of discussion. So this was led by, one of the people is Yuri Treisman, who was at Berkeley and found that he was teaching calculus, and the Asian students were doing very well, and the Black students and Hispanic students weren't doing very well. And he hung out to find out what they were, what was different, because he was convinced that it wasn't differences in ability. And he found the Asian students were all working together, and they would not, they had these study sessions, and everybody was working on the problems, and they wouldn't quit until every member of the group understood everything about the problem. Hmm. Whereas the Black students and the Hispanic students were working totally on their own, and they weren't working together, and when they couldn't figure out something, they got discouraged and dropped the course.
Mm-hmm.
And he got them all working in teams, and everybody succeeded. And that's the model for the Wisconsin Emerging Scholars here, the math program. Mm-hmm. You're probably familiar with
that. I am.
Mm-hmm. And it's been extremely successful here.
Mm.
The Emerging Scholars, well, I'm a little out of date, but I know a few years after it started, they take the same calculus test as everybody else, and even though they were the at-risk students that were counseled into the Emerging Scholars Program, they always got the highest score on the exam, their section.
Hmm.
So I guess another thing is Eric Mazur at, he's in physics, he's at Harvard. There was this, or somebody named Hestinus in Arizona, started giving physics students Professor Hestinus gave a conceptual test. It wasn't problem solving. It was things like a small car and a big truck have a collision. The force of the truck on the car is equal to, less than, or more than the force of the car on the truck. Or you have a boat in a bathtub, and you remove a brick from the center of the boat, is the water in the bathtub going to go up or down? Or, I mean, just very broad.
Right.
I'm probably not even giving the exact examples, but I'm trying to give a impression of the kind of questions. And to his dismay, his students, even the students who got A's on the problem-solving test, didn't do well on this at all. And he published this, and it started a revolution in physics education. And Eric Mazur at Harvard just grabbed the ball on this, and he said, "Not my Harvard students." And so he gave them the same test, and they did just as poorly. And so he totally changed the way he's taught. I mean, this is just examples of, in science education, different people finding what works and what doesn't work. He started doing this thing called concept tests. So he would give, first of all, he realized that most of his teaching was stuff that was in the textbook. He would lecture on something, and then the students would take notes, and then they would know that's what they should study in the textbook, because that's what would be on the exam. He said, somehow this is all backwards, so he started telling the students they had to, he'd give them assignments of what they had to study before they came to lecture. Then they'd get to lecture, and he'd give them some kind of a little very brief test, and he had his classroom all wired up, so it was all electronic. He knew the results instantly. And it was wired to the each student, so he not only knew the group scores, he knew individual student scores. So his system was to have students prepare ahead of time, give kind of a very short mini lecture on something, and give a set of conceptual questions that they had, their multiple choice, and they had to choose. And he would have the students vote on the answer, then he'd have them get in a group and talk together. And he found that when they talked together, the incidence of getting the correct answer went way up. Hmm. Because, and the idea behind it is that somebody who's just mastered a concept is much better at explaining it to a person who's struggling with it than the professor who mastered it 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And if it continued that people were struggling with the concept, he'd explain it some more. But then if people did pretty well, then he'd go on. So much more of the time was spent with the students talking to each other in lecture, and much less time was spent with him speaking.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think, is this, do you see things like this happening in high school classes too? Is it changing? Is science education
yes.
in high schools changing?
So I haven't done any surveys of high school. I only know what happened to my kids at West High. And in physics, my daughter took a physics course where they spent the whole time rolling soup cans down inclined planes and stuff like that. They were doing, and then they had to explain their results to the other people in the class. So it was very much, her teacher must have gone to a workshop where they discussed all these things. It was much more like this. I think that's not universal by any means. And when my son went through biology, he hated it because it was, and he's 4.5 years younger than our daughter. So certainly biology wasn't taught that way at West
mm-hmm.
High School.
Mm-hmm.
And in universities, it's spreading, but it's certainly not universal. But there's incredible amount of data that show that students learn more when they spend a lot of time struggling with concepts and working problems together rather than sitting passively and lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Institute for Science Education, which is, this was a 5-year, very many million-dollar program funded by National Science Foundation. And Wisconsin, there was a series of pre-proposals, and Wisconsin was a finalist, and then had to put in this full-blown proposal, and Wisconsin won it. So the National Institute for Science Education was based in Madison for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't renew it at the end of it. I think they gave them an extra year to finish off some stuff. But so I got very involved in what's called the College Level 1 program, which was teaching introductory science.
And were you teaching?
I was just teaching the labs.
Okay.
But I was very interested in all these issues and very already committed to interactive teaching. And promoting. So I was promoting it in BioCorp.
Mm-hmm.
I was more successful with some people than others.
Did you have any time to get involved in other activities on campus while you were director of the BioCorp program? Other campus committees or academic staff governance or anything like that?
Well, I was involved in a lot of committees that had to do with TA training, biology major, getting a biology advisor that was cross-campus, which turned out to be the model for the cross-campus advising service. So lots of things involving the Center for Biology Education organized an undergraduate biology education committee. I was a very active member of that. In fact, that was the group that I was the chair of the subcommittee of that proposed that we have a biology major, because what had happened was that we have like 30 different biology majors, and students are expected to figure out which college, when they came to Madison, they interested in biology, they had to not only know what major they wanted. They had to know what college, because certain majors are in certain colleges. If you want to major in zoology, you have to be in LNS. If you want to major in horticulture, you have to be in agriculture and life sciences. Mm-hmm. And lots of students will come and say, I don't know what I want to do. I just want to major in biology. So we proposed that there would be a biology major, and it would be in both colleges. And we proposed that there would be a biology advisor who would advise people from both, all the colleges, because mm-hmm. before you could even talk to an advisor, you had to say what college you were in. And before you could say what college you were in, you had to know what major, because certain majors were in certain, and it was just totally wrong from a student's viewpoint. So sure. This undergraduate biology education committee was a bunch of people who cared about how it was for the students and tried to fix it. And we did.
And you did.
Yeah. We did, and we now have a biology advisor, and you can talk to her without knowing what college you're in, and you can major, we now have a biology major, and you can major in it in CALS or LNS. So we did these things. Yeah. I'm very proud of that.
Well, you should be. You should be. Yeah. Could you talk about what's your opinion on the climate for women here? How does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women? And then this is kind of a side question, but maybe you want to talk about that first, and then just the whole issue of girls getting involved in science, mm. You know, how you get them involved from in elementary school through middle school and high school to get them want to come to okay. university.
Okay, so let's do the girls in science one first.
Okay, good.
And I'm very interested in this because I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. Getting girls involved in science has to happen early. I mean, by the time they come to college, they've already decided. And our daughter had a wonderful middle school science teacher, and she got all excited about science. She never got excited about biology, but she now has a PhD in physics.
Huh.
So I think this high school physics teacher I told you about and what they were doing in that class, I think that had a big role in it.
Sure.
And our son was totally turned off by his experiences in science in middle school. He unfortunately didn't have the wonderful person that our daughter did. And just never had any interest in science, even though he was very good at math. And but it's fine with me that he's not in science, but I just see that the decision in both of my children's case got made very early.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
so I think
the way of teaching, it sounds like, is one thing that's going to help.
Yes.
It's just going to get any more people involved, not just girls, but all students
yes.
involved.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think you're right. The issues are not just to get more women involved and girls involved. It's to get everybody more involved. I mean, to be a citizen in this country, you have to understand science. There's so many important issues. And the polls that they do when they ask people questions about basic science are just,
yeah.
It's terrible to hear the results. So we need everybody to be more literate and more interested in science. And that is a really, really big question, and I don't have any good answers,
well,
except that you need to start early, I think.
Yeah.
And I guess the other thing is, I don't know how much about how elementary teachers are prepared to teach science in schools of education. I do know I was quite involved in little projects in my kids' classrooms all from the time they entered school, because I was eager to help out. Some of the elementary teachers welcomed me and just loved having access to resources at the university, and I could get them. You know, I could get them a skeleton at Halloween. I mean, there were all kinds of things I could get them, or X-rays when they were studying bones. And some of the teachers embraced that, and some of the teachers looked at me like, "Oh my God, she's going to find out I don't know anything. I don't want to even talk to her."
Oh dear.
And that was very hard to deal with, because I wasn't in any way being judgmental. I was wanting to help.
Sure.
So. I don't have the answers, but I think early is important, because that, and kids are so curious when they're little, you know, they're just asking questions all the time, and
right.
It's like you have to work to not have them interested.
Yeah.
And this memorize a bunch of stuff is the first way to squelch it, I think. Okay,
okay,
so
how
that,
about the climate,
oh, the
for,
climate
women
for women
on campus?
Okay, so My colleagues have always treated me incredibly well, and everything to do with the BioCorps program, it's been wonderful. The one place where the climate's not so good is treatment of academic staff. So I never felt discrimination about being a woman, but I felt huge discrimination about being an academic staff member. And that's a little bit related, because there's a lot more women who are academic staff, and there's a lot more fewer women who are faculty than men. So I don't know how to quite tease it out, but I'll just give you one example. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mentioned earlier that I was the chair of the subcommittee that instituted the biology major. And this was a very long process. We had to convince a lot of people. A lot of departments were threatened by this. They thought they'd lose majors, and they thought they'd lose resources because of it, even though the deans assured that they weren't counting things like that. Anyway, we worked hard, and we finally succeeded. And at some point along this process, the person who was the chair of the undergraduate biology education, we got a new chair, and he decided he wanted, this was really moving along and going great, and he decided he wanted to be chair of the committee, which was fine with me. I just wanted to get the job done. Anyway, but I'd been involved from the beginning and knew a whole lot more about it than he did, and we just continued getting the job done. And then lo and behold, the biology major is going to be implemented. And I get a letter from the dean of CALS and LNS asking me if I would please be on the implementation committee. However, I was to be a non-voting member because I was not faculty.
Oh.
Anyway, so I sent off an email to Phil Certain, who's one of the signatures of the letter. Phil Certain was a wonderful dean, incredibly supportive of academic staff, incredibly supportive of women. I have no complaints whatsoever and a huge amount of respect for Phil Certain. And I couldn't believe he sent this letter. And he sent me back an email saying, "Anne, I totally agree with you. I just want to get the job done. It was the other dean that insisted on this." So so I forgave Phil, and I served on the committee. But that's the kind of attitude they have. You know, here I work more with undergraduates and advising and biology issues and major issues than anybody on that committee. And they tell me, oh, and one other person who was in my same role as Pat Hendrickson, the biology advisor, who also knows more about the biology major and the problems and the students, who's also academic staff, she was also a non-voting member. So the two people who knew most about the issues and cared most about the issues were non-voting members. And it's so ridiculous because we never voted on anything anyway. There was no reason to have that sentence in the letter other than it was a big put-down.
Yeah.
So, or when the Undergraduate Biology Education Committee, which was assembled by the Center for Biology Education, and was just anybody could be part of this that wanted to, they had contacted people they knew were interested and got this committee together, and we did all these good things. And then the divisional committee decided that there should be more, Biological Sciences Divisional Committee was in charge of curriculum and strategic planning and all kinds of things, but really they spent all their time doing tenure decisions and the other things weren't getting done. So there was a big reorganization at some point and decided that the divisional committee would expand. There would be three arms. There would be an education arm, there would be a strategic planning arm, and then there would be the tenure granting arm. And these were all elected committees. And it was a very good move because this needed to happen. But these were faculty committees. I was not only was I not allowed to run for the undergraduate, the education committee, I wasn't even allowed to nominate people for it. Even though by that point I had what's called faculty status, which is really an honorary thing, it let me vote in the faculty senate elections, that's all. This was a perfect example how having being academic staff with faculty status meant nothing. Anyway, so that committee went on without me, which was fine. I had plenty of other things to do. But that's an example of academic staff. Faculty are in charge of teaching. There are certain academic staff members like me who are full-time teaching undergraduates who are immersed and totally committed to all these issues, and we're not allowed to be on these committees. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's right.
Do you think there's an answer to that? Do you think that's ever going to change? Do you think younger faculty will look any differently at academic staff?
I don't know. I mean, it would be easy to say that academics, I don't know. I guess the Faculty Senate would probably have to be the one making this rule. It would be easy to say academic staff who have primarily teaching responsibilities are eligible to be on the appropriate committees.
Right. You think that would be easy. I agree.
So anyway, like I said, I actually didn't feel discrimination about being a woman. I mean, I didn't feel any bad climate issues, but then I didn't have to come up for tenure or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So,
but you worked with a lot of faculty.
Oh, yeah.
And that was your primary responsibility outside of the students, of course.
Yes. Oh, I did work with a lot of faculty, and I worked, I mean, it was a real pleasure. I especially enjoyed working with some young faculty who were starting out teaching and eager to get feedback, and we worked together very well because they really wanted to do a good job and they appreciated my opinions on how they could improve, and mm-hmm. I appreciated that they wanted to improve.
Sure.
So that worked out very right. well. So I had a lot of, and all these committees, I mean, you know, there's lots of committees besides the ones I talked about that were eager to have me participate. So I did a lot of stuff there, but it helped me too, because it got me connected with people all over campus, which helped very much when I needed to recruit.
I'll bet. Yeah. What about the national scene, Anne? Have you been involved? I would think because this is the program that's been around obviously the longest.
Yeah.
There aren't many. Were you involved nationally in spreading the word about this, or involved in professional organizations, anything like that?
Well, let's see. Nationally, I was involved. Yeah. First of all, the BioQuest Consortium, which I alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. I was on their editorial board and involved with many of their workshops, have many fond colleagues that I'm from all over that I know through that organization. The National Institute for Science Education, I mentioned that earlier. We put on a workshop here on cooperative learning and had quite an impressive website about how to implement cooperative learning and lots of resources on it. I worked on that. That was a national, even though it was based in Madison, so it was actually very nice for me to not have to travel.
Mm-hmm.
Another national thing I was involved with, the chemistry department was the recipient of a big grant called New Traditions. They had several, there were maybe six of these all over the country, multi-university college consortia of improving chemistry education. And I was very interested in this because I mentioned earlier that we have a prerequisite of chemistry for our course, for BioCore. And we were a little bit shocked when students would come into BioCore and we'd allude to some basic chemistry concept and they wouldn't seem to know what it was. And so I was really interested in the issue of how to connect chemistry and biology. And I think if we would have taken the student and asked that same question that we asked that they couldn't answer, if we would have walked them across the street and asked them that question in the chemistry building where they had their chemistry box open, they could have answered it. So mm-hmm. anyway, I was really interested in working with the chemistry faculty so that they could mention occasionally some important concept like energy or something that's going to relate a lot to biology. And though, because those chemistry faculty, you know, there's so many more biology majors sitting there in their chemistry class than there are chemistry majors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's something like 30 chemistry majors a year, and there's hundreds and hundreds of biology majors. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
chemistry, the people who are involved in the New Traditions program were very interested in this issue, and they're very interested in learning communities and connecting. And so they welcomed me, and I became part of the leadership team for the New Traditions Chemistry, having to do with the interdisciplinary course cluster
mm-hmm.
group.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing we tried to do is set up, and this is happening actually quite well at the university now, but this was the first of it, connecting like chemistry, calculus, and we went to the registrar's office and found out, we were trying to connect, well, I wanted to connect biology, but of course we weren't doing, our program was for sophomores, but we needed to, when freshmen first came, we were trying to get them into learning communities where they would be with the same group of students in their chemistry class and their calculus class and maybe their psychology class.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be in the, so we'd link these three courses. Not everybody in all the courses is together, but one discussion section, you'd come and you'd have the chemistry course with these students and you'd have the math course with these students and you have the psychology class with these students. So
mm-hmm.
and then you'd meet with them, and what we were trying to do, which didn't work so well, is have the professors meet and make connections among the courses too. But because this was a small subsection of their great big course, they weren't too interested in putting a lot of effort into that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so this whole idea of learning communities, I worked on that quite a lot, connecting chemistry with other things. And of course, with my chemistry background, that was kind of made sense for me too.
Right.
So national stuff. One of the most exciting things that I did is there's a group called Biology 2010, which was a very high-powered task force, National Academy people, looking at how we should train the next generation of biologists and medical researchers. And they met several times. I mean, it's all very prestigious people doing it. And they had a workshop, and they invited 30 educators to come and talk to them about teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, preparing the next generation of biology researchers, it has a lot to do about teaching courses. So I was one of the people invited to that, and that was really fun.
Oh, I bet. That's very impressive. So you, did you actually...
I gave them a presentation about BioCore and what
mm-hmm.
I thought was important, and
mm-hmm.
and some of the things I've been talking about here about students interacting with each other
mm-hmm.
and what we've learned about how important that is, and
mm-hmm.
about the process of science in the labs, and about writing.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the themes.
Sure.
You can tell what I have passions about here.
Would talk about any honors and awards you've received, and I know there have been because I've read about you, but if just talk
okay.
about the ones that mean the most to you.
Okay. Well, I received 3 teaching awards, one that meant a particularly, well, the Underkoffler Award, which is a system award, meant a lot to me because I got a lot of recognition with that, and that felt really good. But another one that I got was from the undergraduate Golden Key, Madison chapter of the Golden Key Honor Society. And the reason that one meant so much to me is because I was totally student chosen. So the Underkoffler Award was one of these things where you put in this huge packet where you tell your teaching philosophy and you give examples of your materials, and lots of colleagues write letters and students write letters, and it's a whole big deal. But the student thing was totally student organized, and they just told me that they wanted me to come to this banquet because they wanted to give me this award. And they gave awards every year to
mm-hmm.
a small number of faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant a lot. I received a leadership award. Every year there's an academic staff leadership award in many different categories. And I received a leadership award from the Alumni Association, provided the money, and then there's a big reception at the Chancellor's house. So that was very thrilling.
And you retired as distinguished lecturer.
Oh,
that's an honor.
So that was a very big honor, and that one totally, my colleagues organized that. They said, "We want to nominate you for this," and I said, "Oh gosh, I'm really honored." And so, yeah, I think for academic staff to be called distinguished, it's there's a whole process you go through, and there aren't very many of them. So,
mm-hmm.
so that was nice. And then I received the Career Service Award from the College of Letters and Science the year I retired, which was very nice too.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're retired, and have you still stayed involved with the campus at all? Are you doing some things, or have you done some things?
Oh, I'm very involved. Well, first of all, I was one of the first 4 ombudspersons. So Peter Spear started a new program based on some things he had seen at Colorado when he was there. And actually this had been recommended by the Committee on Women and a whole bunch of other different groups, that there would be a ombuds program. And the way it works in Madison is 4 retired faculty and staff have an office and share an office, and it's roughly quarter time each person, but we get a lump sum consultant fee. It's not anything like a quarter time salary, but we're doing it for love, not for money anyway. The idea is to try to help people solve conflicts, try to get people, if somebody's having a conflict, rather than have it escalate until they hate each other and they're suing each other or some awful thing is happening, have them come to the ombuds office. And one of the ombuds, we make an appointment ahead of time with one of the ombuds and sit down and talk. And it totally depends on what the person wants. So any person initiates it, by making an appointment and then comes and talks to ombuds. Lots of times people just want a sounding board. They just want to say, this is what's happening to me and I don't think it's right and what are my options, and we just talk, and sometimes we have some ideas that they hadn't thought about. And sometimes they want us to set up a meeting with the person they're having a conflict with, and then it's totally dependent on what the person who initiates this whole thing wants. Sometimes they want it to be totally confidential, and then it is. In fact, we even got the university lawyers and everything to rule on all this confidentiality. So there's a huge, very high degree of confidentiality. So maybe somebody, for example, thinks they've been sexually harassed, but they don't want to go to the office to report it that deals with that, because that's a public, that's confidential to a certain extent, but if the process goes a certain distance, the names become open. Mm-hmm. So they might want to come to the ombuds office and talk about whether they want to do that or not. And then if they decide to do it, then they go to the, I stopped doing this, equity and diversity office. Anyway, place that handles that.
Mm-hmm.
Luis Pinheiro is the person in charge of that. So one of the things we did as ombuds is get lots of training about all the different organizations at the university that help people solve problems about, if it's a civil service, who are the people that deal with that, and who are faculty senate, academic staff, assembly, and we met with all kinds of university lawyers anyway to learn all about these different bodies and what they do, so we would know where to either get more information or where to refer people. And so sometimes people just want information. Sometimes they want help drafting a letter. Sometimes, as I said, they want to meet with somebody. Another common occurrence is there's a group of people who have to work together, and for some reason they're having trouble working together and they want to just all meet together. And maybe the ombuds might. I remember one department where there was a supervisor and a bunch of people that worked. And the supervisor came and said, can I get some help? And the ombuds working with that met with the supervisor and then each of the four individuals. And then later on they all met together. But everybody got to be heard in a non-threatening atmosphere. And so sometimes we're really able to help people. Sometimes people are trying to figure out, maybe the best thing for me to do is just apply for a transfer to a different unit.
Mm-hmm.
So being a sounding board is a lot. And then there was another case I was involved with where the people just wanted to tell their story and be heard, and for me to say, you were really treated badly. Yeah. I mean, we're supposed to be neutral. Mm-hmm. I got to be careful. I guess you just have to use your judgment about when something wrong has happened. And then in some cases, we're also charged with if there's some policies that the university either doesn't have an appropriate policy, or the policy ought to be changed. Because it's under the whole idea of improving the climate. The ombuds office is trying to improve the climate. And I think it's very good. And we do a lot of publicity, so people have to know we're there. That's one of the issues, is getting the word out. So we go to a lot of new employee orientation kinds of things. And anyway, I think it's a very good program, and I'm very happy to be involved. But I actually am no longer involved because it was stressing me a lot.
Oh.
I wasn't very good at detaching, even though I think I could act in a non-judgmental and a fair, fair way. My emotions were getting all riled up when I'd hear these stories, and I said, "This isn't what I retired about." So, but that was a failing to me. The other people didn't. They were much more able to detach. So it's not in any way a failing of the ombuds office. Mm-hmm. It's a failing of me. And the other thing I do now, I love this. So. The Prairie Project got me involved in what was then the Campus Natural Areas, which used to be managed by the Arboretum, and then there was a task force, which I was a member of, that recommended a campus committee, which became the Campus Natural Areas Committee, and then I was on that committee, which has to do with governing all the green space, like Lecture Path and Picnic Point and Eagle Heights Woods and Biocore Prairie. Anyway, and now this has just gotten better and better all the time. Now we have a new name, which is the UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve, and all kinds of good things are happening. There's going to be a lot of fundraising so that we can actually do a lot more work to things like removing invasive species and planting native species and controlling erosion and making the trail system work better so that it's more logical and removing redundant trails that are causing erosion. So anyway, I've become very involved. I was UW-Madison Lakeshore Nature Preserve. So I do things to help the field manager, Kathy Bruner, somebody I love working with. And I do stuff like pulling garlic mustard, you know, the ever-present nasty invasive species. And I still, I also work a lot in the Biocorp Prairie still, more weeds to pull there. Parts of the prairie are doing really well, but parts are still really weedy, so we're struggling with weeds. So I spent a lot of time in this, and I've taken up quilting, and I meet with a group of women every Monday morning, and we work on our projects and bring them in when they're done and show them to each other and learn new things from each other, which has been a lot of fun. Yeah. And I have, my two children are grown up. One's, our daughter's at Princeton. She's a postdoc there. I visit her. Our son is a filmmaker in Los Angeles. I can visit him. And my husband, Dick Burgess, gets invited all kinds of interesting places, and I never could go before because I was teaching.
Wonderful.
And so now I can go on trips with him. So I've traveled a lot. And my days are so unstressed. It's just, I still feel like I'm on vacation. I can't believe that, you know, I don't have terrible problems to solve anymore.
Well, then I hate to back up because all that sounds so wonderful, but this is an important question, I think. When you were working, how did you balance your life? I mean, you had...
Okay, well, I don't think I did a very good job with that. Very fortunately, when my children were little, I had a 9-month appointment in the beginning, and then I got very involved in doing stuff in the summertime, too. But I was only working, for a long time, only worked part-time in the summertime. And when my kids were really little, I was not working full-time. And at that point, I was just doing the cell biology lab, and I didn't have all those other responsibilities. So it was much more manageable. And then when things got really intense and crazy, they were already gone. I mean, they were either, 1990, 12 years ago. Andreas was still home then. But anyway, my kids kept me grounded for a long time because you got to be there to pick them up when the after-school program gets done or whatever. I had to be there. In the summers, what I was doing during the summer is revising the lab manuals and designing new labs, and the time was very flexible, so it was beautiful in the summer that I had work to do, but it wasn't full-time, and it wasn't, I could do it on my own schedule because it wasn't teaching. But during the academic year, when there were 6 3-hour labs a week, and I wasn't present in every lab all the time, but I had a tremendously scheduled day because I also, since I was doing all this coordinating stuff and trying to help courses make connections and know what's going on in the other courses, I went to a lot of the lectures to be aware of what was going on, and because of some of the faculty who wanted my feedback. And then there's a lot of TA meetings, and I didn't do a very good job of balancing. One of the reasons I retired early is because I was going crazy. And the other thing I was not very good at is I couldn't just say to myself, Anne, do the best job you can, and then forget about it. I would get all emotionally involved in all these issues. You know, I was much too emotionally involved, which in hindsight I can look back now. I mean, I even knew it at the time, but even if I told myself that with my head, it didn't change the way I did stuff. So I was passionate about what I was doing.
Well, that's it. I think that's the positive way to put that. Well, the questions are, we're finished with the questions. Okay. The last one is, what do you do for fun and relaxation? And you talked about your traveling and your quilting and the work you've done with the prairie.
And the preserve.
Yeah. How do you keep your energy up?
Oh, I just have, there's no problem with that. I just love the stuff I'm doing. Yeah. I guess the other thing is my father died a long time ago, but my mother remarried and still lives in Evansville, little tiny town, you know, 23 miles from here. And she's quite old now. So one of the things I do is I spend time with her. Mm-hmm. And now I know it's just great that I have time to do this. And when she needs to be taken to a doctor's appointment, I can stuff like that. So I love the freedom of retirement. I thought I might miss having people need me or something. I haven't missed anything. I mostly haven't missed, after I retired, it was just like this huge weight was off my shoulders. I loved what I did. I loved my colleagues. I loved my students. But that I was so, it was such a big load. It was such a relief to, every day still feels like vacation to me. I have no problem with keeping my energy up, and I'm doing a million things. In fact, I thought I was going to be sitting around at home reading books a lot, but somehow,
yep.
With all, I mean, I am involved in a lot of things with the preserve, and I love doing that. It's something I care about, and it's something I feel like I'm making a contribution. It's important to feel like you're making a contribution.
Sure.
Okay, so that's probably a good place to end.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Great story.